Hello, and welcome to Era on Air, the official podcast of the Australian Institute of Refrigeration, Air Conditioning, and Heating. Today's episode is an adaptation of the cover feature of a recent issue of Ecolibrium, Era's official industry journal. The article looks at 25 King Street, Australia's largest and tallest engineered timber office building. It's a project that has pushed boundaries in construction, sustainability, and indoor environment quality. Today on the podcast, we're speaking to two mechanical service engineers from Oricon. We talk about some of the unique challenges of this project, timber buildings in general, exposed mechanical services, and getting to work on a building that's also going to be your future office. Thank you for joining us today, and if you're enjoying Era on Air, we'd love it if you'd tell a friend. I'm your host, Mark Spencer. Let's get started.
My name is Joel Fernandez, and I'm a mechanical engineer at Oricon.
Hi, I'm Danny Roberts, and I'm a mechanical engineer at Oricon.
According to Danny Roberts, the project's WELL and Green Star rating design objectives were synergistic, with several of the design requirements and intents overlapping. WELL-specific design requirements included increased outside air rates, HEPA-level filtration of air within the lobby and end-of-trip spaces, and future spatial provision for activated carbon filters on all air conditioning equipment. She says, well, we've got her right here with us. Danny, well, what did that kind of mean in practice? Was it easier to get both a WELL rating and a Green Star rating simultaneously for this project?
Look, I would say it definitely is because they have a lot of similarities. They're effectively different tools in the way they're evaluated. WELL's being the more recent tool that's been implemented into the industry. Slightly different criteria, but a lot of it does have synergy. As you mentioned, things like filtration and air quality. We did start working on the WELL's rating a little bit later, so Green Star was always a given at the start of the project, and then we decided to go for the WELL's rating a little bit afterwards, but because we had the benefit of already targeting the Green Star, much easier to implement. So on a base building, both of them easy to achieve, maybe a little bit of more cost to a project because you do have to add in, like you said, filtration. Your acoustic criteria is a little bit more stringent. So a few design considerations. So you wouldn't want to go down the path of designing everything and then try to achieve either of the ratings. Looking at a fit out type of implementation of a WELL's rating is a whole other kettle of fish. So a few differences there, but I know the industry is sort of moving towards WELL's as a rating now because it's more around I guess wellbeing, which is the name WELL's, but looking after people and that really good working environment.
Do you remember looking back, Danny, when it was decided to go for that WELL rating? It wasn't already when the building was in construction, was it?
No, I think it was, well, we designed the fit out for Oricon as well, so it was sort of around the time that we started designing our fit out. So I think we might have been just before tender with the base building, so working out, you know, finalizing our design and then started to look into it at then. So it was a bit of a scramble. But like I said, most of it was easy to implement because we were halfway there. So
another quote from the article was that no hot works were permitted on the site during the construction phase. This obviously created a challenge for the AG Coombs team when cutting the ductwork for spigots and the like. This was further complicated by the fact that all mechanical services are fully exposed on the office floors, attached to the exposed CLT soffits. So was that very rare, this full exposure of the mechanical services in the building? And did it present any particular issues with noise or amenity to building residents? You know, I assume this would be quite important as you're both residents yourselves in the new building. Joel, did that make it more complicated having all the ductwork and mechanical services exposed?
Yeah, I think a lot of focus is on the mechanical ductwork and building services, MEC being one of the biggest physically that you can see. I think a lot of it's got to do with ensuring a really high quality of the install, especially for a building full of engineers, which we are, but even for just normal residents of the building, it is, you know, very much something that your eye is drawn to. And, you know, if there's any irregularities in surface finish or, you know, quality of the install, it's really easy to pick up across levels. We obviously had a very tight requirement around the quality of install and fit and finish, and a lot of effort was put in upfront. not just to make sure that our specification was very clear about our expectations about quality, but also to make sure that the services within each other, aligned on the ceiling and, created, visually appealing, or might not be the right term, but at least consistent patterns and at least look structured and intentional, which is a major focus.
Do you have a perspective on that, Danny, how it was kind of different in this project having everything exposed?
Yeah, look, the outcome was amazing. A lot of people comment when they come and look at the building and they just say how well everything's aligned. So because we modeled it all in 3D and then handed that model over to the trades and then they followed suit and kept that coordination in place, the results just outstanding. It looks so good. So I think putting that time in at design and making sure that everything is aligning and working and the colors work really, really can give you an outstanding project.
That's excellent. And I assume a noise is a big factor then, of course, as well with the services being exposed. Later on, we'll touch on that briefly, Joel. You mentioned it's quite an important aspect of the design right from the start to think about controlling for noise in this fit out. But before we get to that, we've got a question here from the article about the fire control system for the building. 25 King features a standard smoke control system and automatic stair pressurization systems to serve the fire isolated exits. But since cross-laminated timber is an unusual building material, a limited range of fire dampers that have been tested for the application exist in the marketplace. So this led to a fully designed and coordinated solution, with the project's structural team being sought at the earliest stages of the project. The use of fire dampers within timber walls is not a standard detail, and therefore only specific fire damper products and arrangements have been type tested and deemed to comply, explains Joel. So Joel, how different was this from a typical project you've worked on with only having a very limited range of fire damper products to choose from? Did that really matter much on this project?
Yeah, absolutely. I would say in most conventional fire damper installs, the penetration can be cut on site to match the fire damper, or if not, any gaps or penetration corrections can be pretty easily made on site and filled in. We didn't really have this option on 25 King, as all the penetrations are on display, as well as they were pre-cut, so there wasn't really an option to change penetration sizes or locations on site. Fire dampers are essentially safety devices, and because of this, there are very strict requirements about how, when, and where they can be installed. And at the time of design, I believe there's only one fire damper system on the market that was certified for use in timber walls. And for this reason, our design was based around a particular manufacturer's standard sizes. And I mean, this meant that we had to coordinate quite closely with the structural designers to ensure the penetrations were sized correctly. And as well, when we locked in the fire damper locations, they didn't move it throughout the project. It also meant the fit and finish of the fire damper, the timber connection, had to be really tight and look quite good. And that's something the construction team did a great job on.
So, Joel, I just had a quick question about sort of whether 25 King Street fell into this kind of chicken and egg camp where it's one of the first projects, so obviously there's a lot of teething problems potentially, but were you ever caught in a situation where kind of the industry wasn't ready, or you were kind of waiting for certification of certain elements of the building before the project could proceed? What did it kind of feel like working in this kind of nascent field?
Yeah, I think it's interesting, that concept of a chicken and egg. Fortunately, I think regardless of which one came first, there were a sort of precedents in Australia. This is, I think, maybe the second or third of this scale timber buildings built in this manner. There is actually another project, in Barangaroo, I think, in Sydney, that has a very similar structure and mechanical system. And there were a lot of lessons learned there that we could take from the developer land lease. One of those, obviously, being the fire dampers. But I think in terms of the industry being ready, certainly the mechanical trades, they're sort of different ways of working, but I don't think that the core skills need to change too much. We spoke previously about the limitations of hot works on site. That's a safety issue on other sites, but certainly where there's timber, it also can be an aesthetic thing. Like, you don't want even small flames or scorching of timber where cutting things on site. So I think there needed to be that early contractor understanding of different expectations working with timber, but certainly a lot of the skills from conventional buildings apply to timber buildings just as much. And being while there is a lot of timber around, a lot of the mechanical services are obviously still 100% metal and concrete and copper. So there wasn't a huge learning curve for the mechanical services or building services in general on the job.
So as the mechanical engineer, one of the mechanical engineers for the project, Joel, for Oricon, you shared some of the main lessons you learned from the project. And they were the acoustic requirements for achieving the well rating can be very tough to achieve. And you say to start the design with this in mind. What did that kind of look like in purpose, and how did you work with Danny to achieve that?
Yeah, I think acoustics is a kind of tricky one. It's often sort of overlooked, I guess, from at least initial planning or space planning point of view in buildings. As this is a timber building, the acoustic properties of the buildings like this aren't as well documented or well understood. A lot of effort was made up front by the services team in conjunction with the acoustic consultants to make sure that noise generated by the mechanical plant wasn't a disturbance, not just to occupants of the building, but the surrounding buildings. The well noise criteria is a weighted measurement with adjustments for tonal noise. And what we actually found is, obviously, the well rating requirement came in a little bit later in the design process, that there were some areas that were at risk to local noise. But we were able to workshop that out through a combination of, I guess, there were a couple of tweaks, the final duct runs and duct pressures, as well as making sure that from a commissioning, so after construction, that the duct pressures were as they're expected. We weren't getting huge pressure drops, at bends or before VAVs or control gear. So I think it's a combination of making sure things upfront are designed correctly, but also making sure that any of the assumptions that you've made in the design process, be it around commissioning values or final install, actually carries over to the final construction and commissioning. And that's something that I think we went back and forward a couple of times on this job, just because there was quite stringent requirements. And we ended up having independent acoustic consultant come out and verify some of our results. And there's a bit of back and forward, there are a couple of quirks about the interface from the plant level to the level below. But in the end, it ended up in quite a good result and quite a pleasant space to be in. Acoustics, very similar to, I think, air conditioning in some respects, is a very subjective criteria. But overall, I think it's been really, really good.
Yeah, the subjectivity of acoustics is really interesting, like you mentioned there, Joel. Is it the way it gets measured, is it sort of leaning a lot on just the empirical things you can measure, just decibel levels and something that is kind of a bit subjective in terms of pitches, like if you get a whine that isn't very loud, but it's just that right tone that it might really frustrate some people. Can you catch them in the earlier phases, or is it kind of you have to build it and then sort out any issues? Or are we kind of entering that BIM phase of that kind of future of everything gets built digitally before it's ever built physically, and you can catch these problems before they ever really exist?
Yeah. I think that's part of the real fun of engineering. Is a lot of it is anecdotal experience, or you just know where there might be some pain points. In our instance, we knew that there was always going to be tight areas around the riser where a lot of the services are coming out of that main core area. And for that reason, we just paid specific attention to those areas. Sometimes you can only really fix, there might be some unusual things that pop up. So as you said, ducts squealing because of leaks or high pressure drops, those kind of things you can only really address once they pop up. But a design perspective would be, number one, how can we minimize the noise? And number two, how can we make sure that if there is going to be noise, the places or people that will hear it won't be affected by it? Lending to, I guess, the problem is that our fit out is actually very open plan, as well as we have task-based working. So there's a lot of opportunities for staff to move around. And strangely, I think that leads to some, it ties into lessons learned, is that it becomes even harder to please everyone because people are moving around and they might get used to the way that glare happens in the afternoon if they have the same desk every day, but they don't have that opportunity to get used to the acoustics or the noise or the sunlight falling on their desk or even the temperature just caused by sunlight. So those little quirks, I think, are something that everyone needed to get used to. But I think the key takeaway is that we've had a bit of a fine-tuning process and no one's complained. There's a lot less complaints now than there was 6 months ago.
Good. So you said another thing that was really important was coordination with other services and structures, particularly because the mechanical services on this project were exposed. Was that sort of coordination on the design side, the build side, or on the operations side now that the building's complete?
Yeah, sure. All of that coordination really needs to happen up front, I think, for a really high quality product. We were forced to an extent, or I think it was, we identified very early that it was imperative that we have really high coordination on this job because of the requirement to cut penetrations off-site. And that really drove a lot of the design decisions up front. You know, where risers would turn or where services would cross over were really, really focused on. But we also knew that being exposed services, that there would be also, you know, aesthetic purposes as well as, you know, good design process to have, you know, very similar, almost like procedurally generated, I guess, design. So we, from the very onset, we basically, you know, had a workshop with every service and said, you know, here's the zones where we want to target. These are your zones. Mechanical teams stay here, electrical on the sides. And I think we were able to get rid of, you know, maybe 90% of the conflicts up front. And then as the design progresses, obviously you can't capture every instance, but you can it certainly cuts down on, you know, the back and forward.
So Joel, are we getting to the point that the building is getting sort of fully built digitally in this building information modeling system or BIM system, and then it's kind of just following those plans, or is that a little bit more sci-fi than what we're actually up to?
Yeah, I think we're pretty close, actually. I think especially in this kind of job, it was a very modular design. So often, you know, some of the elements that probably don't directly, you know, correspond in real life, it will be like structural elements or final duct runs. But because of the tight level of coordination, as well as, you know, the requirement for exposed services, really the design model actually corresponds almost identically to real life. It's sort of a pet project of mine right now on this model, because I spent a lot of the time modeling some of the equipment myself, is to actually bring it back to 100% as it was constructed into the digital world. So I think there is that back and forward. Yeah, we designed it at the desktop. It's a fully modeled and detailed 3D design, and then we take it into the, you know, into real life, into the real world, and then there's almost that back and forward. You know, what's changed from the digital model to real life, and what changes do we need to make to the digital model to make it realign with real life? And I think we're pretty close. I mean, I'm seeing a lot of interesting stuff in the industry where people are taking, you know, basically design documentation and construction documentation and moving it into asset management documentation.
In terms of practicalities of getting the information back from what you have built back into the model, what does that sort of look like in practice? Is it pretty exact measurements of, okay, well, the model didn't have exact placement for this duct. Now we have installed it. Are we actually measuring it's X many meters from this wall to the start of the duct, and then this many meters from the other side of the duct to the far wall? To get that very exact information, the geospatial information, into the model from real life, are people sort of out there actually measuring stuff?
I guess the core question you have to ask, and sort of answering the question in a roundabout way, is what do you want that end model for? Are you using it to be an exact replica of you know, what you've built, or are you actually using it for more, you know, pragmatic purposes? And I guess maybe those last 2 or 3 millimeters may not make a huge difference if you're using it to plan asset management. But I guess I've seen a couple of different ways of doing it. Yes, there's probably the more mundane measuring it on site, but I've also seen teams using, you know, laser scanning, or I guess a photogrammetry, I believe is the right term, to convert, you know, photos or, you know, point measurement data back into a model.
Good point you made about duct heat gain and losses. Because everything is exposed in this project, in this building, the heat gain and loss can be quite significant. Did that make it a bit harder when you were going for that Green Star certification? Was that actually representing quite a bit of lost energy in the amount of heat you were gaining and losing in the ductwork that had to be compensated for by the plant?
It's interesting. It doesn't actually end up meaning that the building uses less or more energy, but what it does mean is that the energy that we're trying to get to, you know, that person in the furthest corner of the building may not be getting to them. So in this case, you know, we're trying to cool that person down in the corner and they may not be getting cold enough air. It's actually pretty common practice, I'd say, in concealed services. So, you know, conventional, to put a bit of effort into working out how much energy is lost into the ceiling cavity. That obviously means that you can work out the expected temperature of the air being supplied to the final space. However, we sort of double down on this problem on 25 King because of our exposed services, because not only was our supply air being warmed by traveling through an occupied space, but we're also cooling spaces that ductwork was traveling in. So while the ductwork was losing heat, gaining heat from the space, it was also giving back some cold or cooling the people underneath it. Technically, because it's an exposed services job, we didn't actually need to have any insulation on the ductwork, at least not for NCC Section J requirement. Mm-hmm. But what we found is that we actually needed some amount of insulation to reduce any condensation risks, as well as to reduce the total heat gain, which isn't wasted energy, but means that, you know, we can accurately predict the temperature of the air going into spaces. Our final design actually has 25 millimeters of insulation for all exposed ducts, which is slightly lower than what you'd expect in a concealed services design. And we've made an allowance for that by also decreasing the AHE supply temperature. And this total heat gain is actually still really significant on the job, probably around 90 kilowatts off the top of my head, but it's manageable. And it's actually really important to note that it isn't energy lost. It's still providing cooling. It's just not providing cooling in the final area.
Mm-hmm. Just finally, I've been calling this timber a lot as kind of the layperson here, but of course the technical term is cross-laminated timber. Do you feel like it's appropriate to kind of refer to it in the shorthand as just timber? Or is this kind of a different material than that you'd think from calling it timber?
I guess you're probably getting a mechanical engineer's viewpoint on this. Yep. Structural topic. But no, I think there's probably, it's kind of widely accepted in the engineering industry that when you're saying timber, that there may be something a little bit different about it than your conventional, you know, wooden items that you might see at home. Certainly there is differences in the buildup of each of the timber columns and structural pieces. As you said, there's a cross-laminated timber, CLT, and glulam that are both used on this project. But I don't think there's a huge risk. I think it just needs to be made clear to, I guess, the wider community. And again, speaking to non-engineering or maybe people not directly related to the building industry, that there is engineering rigor, I guess, put around the material. It's not just standard timber, just in the same way that, you know, the metal that you might see at home is different to the metal that you might see at a job site. And I think we're probably getting to that point where people are realizing that it's not exactly the same as the timber that you might have in your house. But I certainly see what you're saying about the risk about using that sort of more colloquial terminology.
Did you ever picture back in your studies or when you were kind of new in the industry that you'd be working on a timber frame structure one of these days?
No, not at all. But I think it's definitely been a very eye-opening experience and certainly been a pleasure talking to you a little bit about my experiences on the project. So thank you very much for having me.
Absolute pleasure, Joel. Thank you. And thank you for joining us for today's episode of Era on Air. Again, today's episode was an adaptation of the April cover feature of Ecolibrium, ERA's industry journal, and you can read the article in full at ERA's website, and you'll find a link to it in our show notes. I'd like to thank Danny and Joel for their time in speaking to me. If you've got any specific questions about timber buildings, exposed mechanical services, or if you heard anything in today's episode you'd like to learn more about, just send us an email to era@era.org.au. That's ERA, A-I-R-A-H. I've been your host, Mark Spencer, and until next time, stay cool.